Good morning, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio Sinoland, and I am not on the D-Day beaches of France. I am in Changsha, Hunan, China, with my good friend and comrade, Amir Khan. How are you doing, Amir?
I'm doing great, Jeff. Very happy to be on China Rising Radio Sinoland. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I actually interviewed Amir, it's been probably three or four years ago, about his first book. He is an author. He has written a second book, published it. He has written the third book that he has in the tank, and he is now contacting publishers, and he has been published in several academic journals, so he's a writer. He is also an esteemed member of the China Writers Group, and so we stay in touch. And since I was in Shenzhen, since I am in Shenzhen for most of the month of May, I had to come up and see Amir and say hello to such a good friend and see Changsha again, because I was here in 2018, and my God, what a city! But we'll get to that. Anyway, Amir, thank you for being on the show. Another live one. I did one with Metallic Man in Zhuhai.
Wow, great.
And I'm going to do another one with Dongping Han in Hong Kong on the 26th.
Yeah, I'm really with esteemed company. It really is an honor.
Thank you, Jim. Well, Amir, tell us just quickly, you explained to me you were your parents are from Pakistan. They immigrated to Canada.
Correct.
Tell us about that. And so that people know a little bit about where you came from, where you come from, et cetera.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I always say whenever anyone asks me in China or elsewhere where I'm from, I always, I say Canada because I'm a citizen of Canada. I have a Canadian passport. I was born, however, in Pakistan. And how Pakistani am I? That's always the question, that second generation immigrants sort of have to think about. Anyway. I don't say this with any particular pride or shame at all. I was born in July 1981. I'm dating myself. And our family moved to Canada in December 1981. So I virtually have no memory of Pakistan. And in our household, we only spoke English. I mean, at least our parents only spoke English to my brother and I growing up. So I'm unilingual, Canadian, born in Pakistan, teaching English literature to English majors at a university in China. How about that?
Now, you have a PhD, and I mean, many people get a bachelor's. Some people get a master's. Very few people get a PhD. What was your passion? What was your muse that drove you or inspired you to get a PhD? Because it's a lot of hard work. Tell us about that.
I mean, maybe the first contingency was I was afraid to leave school and go to work. That was very frightening for me. So I wanted to stretch out my graduate school years for as long as possible. But even if you want to do that, yes, you're right. It's very competitive, very few spots, a lot of people competing for those spots. And there were some really close calls, even getting into the master's program and then making the leap from master's to PhD, and I had some really good people help me and sort of give me the boost that I needed at times. And then why did I, I did a bachelor's, I remember, and kind of a funny story I sort of repeat often. But when I was doing my bachelor's, I really thought, I'm not really very brilliant guy. I can get a BA, a bachelor's, but there's really brilliant literature people or whatever, and they will go and do their master's. But then I would be talking with some of my friends, and I would listen to them, and they would say, yeah, I'm going to, apply for my master's. And then I was like, you are going to apply for your master's? Wait a minute. I'm not brilliant, but I'm better than you. So I'm going to also apply for my master's. So then I got into a master's program, and now I was like, I'm not a PhD caliber kind of a guy. There's other people, really brilliant people, they go and do their PhD. But then the same kind of deal happened. I would be talking with some of my colleagues. My MA students, also with me, and they would tell me that they're applying for their PhD. What? You? No. I'm not brilliant, okay, but I'm better than you. So if you are applying to do your PhD, I will too, because I'm not going to listen to how you got into a PhD program. But actually, once I got to my PhD program, then it changed, because at that point, I started meeting people who were so brilliant and either couldn't finish their PhD because of life reasons, family, you know, you get older when you're in a PhD program, they had a bad supervisor. Then I started to panic because I was like, oh my God, you didn't get your PhD? If you didn't get your PhD, how the hell am I going to get my PhD? And the same thing after even looking for jobs. So some really brilliant, talented people who just don't get picked up by the, you know, tenure track system. Very few spots, especially in literature and humanities. So I graduated PhD 2013. And for about 2 years, I was just like, underemployed or unemployed, very horrible, anxious time. It seemed like I wouldn't be able to use my degree at all. I would have to switch to another industry, and I was really, you know, at my wit's end looking for work in Canada, just little small tutoring English jobs, high school students and stuff like that to survive. And then 2 years of unemployment, 2013, in the fall of 2015, in the spring of 2015, a joint business college, Missouri State University, and they have a normal university, but in a hybrid business school in Dalian, China. And I was just applying everywhere. I was just throwing out resumes because, dear God, I need a lifeline. I need somebody to help me or to give me a chance to do the work that I was trained to do. Yeah. And the first opportunity I got was in Dalian, China. And no problem. I know everyone asks me, oh, that's interesting. Why did you choose Dalian? Why did you choose China? You know, they gave me a job. So I needed money badly. So I approved. And that was really great. You know, Mike Coots was the first guy who hired me, and I even thanked him in the acknowledgments of my second book. But wow, he really did. Threw me a lifeline, because I, like I said, have so many friends way more talented than me, left the academy, you know, they published way more than me, more books, more articles, and they never found their job in the right city, you know, and some of them have spouses and kids and stuff like that. But my situation and whatever, an opportunity was there, and I just took it, and I'm still able to do the work that I've been trained to do, which is, you know, basically literature.
Awesome. Now we're in Changsha, which is in the central part of the country. Totally different vibe than up north.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about Dalian and what you liked about it. By the way, if you get the map, it's basically at the tip of that peninsula that sticks down into the, I think it's the Bohai Sea. And it was actually colonized by the Russians and the Japanese. It was called Port Arthur, and it's now one of the major deep water ports in the world. And interestingly, has a Mediterranean climate, just like California. So tell us about Dalian, what you liked about it, what you didn't like about it, and what it taught you.
I'll always sort of remember Dalian very warmly, just because that was my first opportunity, especially the school that gave me the opportunity, the normal Missouri State University. You know. So that was great. But I worked for two schools, actually, when I was there, and I sort of made a switch. And also was at Dalian Maritime University, another great school. And that's when I actually first started teaching literature, because at the business school, there wasn't much opportunity to teach literature. I was teaching writing. I mean, it was great. It was a great start, no complaints. But, you know, if I wanted to do literature, they gave me the opportunity at this Maritime University. And they had really bright students, actually. It's a small foreign languages college. All of their other more prestigious departments, you know, marine engineering and all this kind of stuff, top of the line, but a very small foreign languages department. But it was really a lot of fun teaching literature to those kids, really bright kids. So yeah, anyway, so I taught at those two schools, so I remember both very, very fondly. The city itself, Dongbei, Dalian is kind of, in terms of, you know, nightlife, it's a very quiet city. It goes to sleep very early, you know, it's 9:30 or 10 o'clock. I believe the last ETA, like the last SkyTrain, It's like 9:30 or 9:40. Like, that's a little too early. And sometimes you want to, you know, have a little fun or go out for a drink with some friends or whatever. And, yeah, the nightlife there is just, and then after COVID, it really sunk to a new low. And now it's just like people, you know, we both are communists and we are people. We are men of the people. And we love the people. We love to see the people, the women, out on the street. And in Dalian, you know, everybody is happy in their homes. But that's okay. We love them too. But here in Changsha, come and visit. You've never seen anything like that, right, Jeff? World. There's seas of people all hours of the day. Makes you feel energized. Makes you feel like, yeah, it's okay. The people are out. The people are happy, enjoying their life. You can enjoy your life, you know, a bit more too. So that's one big difference and one thing I really like about Hunan. And, you know, it's a different vibe, different sort of city.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Changsha is the political capital of Hunan. It's where Mao Zedong grew up. It is the really the groundswell of the Communist Party of China and its entire history going back to 1921. In fact, we visited the museum of the Communist Party of Changsha yesterday, which was an amazing visit. But anyway, yeah, Changsha is something to behold.
You must have some pics of that on your Twitter.
Yeah, on my Twitter. It's just amazing. So, and Amir's done a great job showing me around. Tell us a little bit about, of course, you unashamedly came here for more money, which is what professors do. And tell us a little bit about what you're doing here, your teaching, your publishing, et cetera.
Oh, so, you know, actually this was also the case at Dalian Maritime University. You know, both schools are making a play, and Chinese universities in general are really aggressive and pushing to become top world-class universities, to attract top world-class talent, not just in terms of faculty, I mean, like in terms of students, especially maybe even Chinese students living abroad, the diaspora or whatever. So they're pushing hard. And I think guys like me have been hired, there are teaching responsibilities, but there are sort of, you know, ranking systems, you know, but they're not domestic ranking systems, unfortunately, Western, centric, whatever, SSCI journals, ANACI journals. But the world ranking system being what it is, you know, China's trying to compete in those systems and trying to get, you know, more citations and more researchers publishing in specific journals. And
Western journals.
Sure, definitely.
In English or French or whatever.
So they hired me, you know, I think mostly to get, you know, the Hunan Normal University name and print out into, you know, into those journals, because check off certain boxes and you move up and rank in terms of funding from what you receive from the federal government, the central government, and stuff like that. So anyway, my point is, yeah, they gave me a very light teaching load, so I'm grateful for that. And I have lots of time to read and write, and I have been very productive in the past. I've only been here for one semester in my this semester, so almost a year. Very productive, but I have lots of things in the pipeline. And for whatever reason, publishing has been a real challenge. And maybe we can talk about the condition of the state of academic publishing right now. I really feel like it's very difficult unless you're parroting things that, you know, people want to hear. But this is, you know, true of all language, whether it's the news media or whether it's academic publishing, whether, you know, there's this feeling like kind of an exhaustion. You know, there's just so much information out there that to break in with a new voice, it's not even that they're not convinced by it. It's just that there's the currents moving in, you know, conventional directions are so strong because there's so much information on there. Mm-hmm. That swimming against the current is very difficult, even if somebody kind of appreciates the work or appreciates, you know, how, the way you see things. It's just the colossus, the information publishing colossus, not only academic, but in trade publications, and especially news media, fake news and stuff like that. It is so hard to push back.
The big lie propaganda.
Yeah. And information itself is
a big lie propaganda.
Yeah. I mean, what is the difference between, yeah, just any idea that okay, academic publishing is sort of holier or more held to higher standards or rigors. Well, that is a bit misplaced, right? There's still the rules of the game, there's still conventions, and there's still standard narratives, and a lot of them are distorted. Like I always tell my students, I don't know, right, how anybody can be a historian without being a revisionist in some capacity, because all of the mainstream narratives, and even his professional historians will say this about their own discipline. You specialize in a certain field, and basically how you specialize is to say, well, the mainstream is wrong, and I have this new angle. And that's how everyone survives in these sort of isolated pockets of revisionist against some hegemonic thing. But in a sense, the hegemon itself requires the dissenting voices not coalesced against it, but in response to it to justify its own existence.
Yeah.
So when you're publishing academically, you know, you're on the margins, you're on the fringe, but even your resistance is sort of co-opted, and it only makes sense in opposition to the mainstream narrative, which carries the day. How you break that, I mean, I'm not sure. But, you know, we do what we can individually, one by one. You know.
Well, even if you had gotten a job at a university in anywhere in the West.
No, I'm so glad.
I just want to say, and you told them you were a communist, you would not have, they would have fired you that
day. Oh, yeah,
day.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So at least you have the freedom here. And you can be a neoliberal here. Now,
oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
You can be a neoliberal. You can, you know, there's a much more flexibility and much more tolerance of ideas in universities here. And just like when I would go to the library in Shenzhen, they had works by all the neoliberal, you know, Fukuyama or whatever, all these neoliberal writers. You know?
I'm the one getting antsy. I want to write a letter to the parties, and you just don't let this into the school. Garbage term.
So, you know, you and I both, you know, I found out very late. It wasn't until I came back to China in 2010, we had gone bankrupt and we were broke, and we came back for our second time, 7 years in the early 90s, and we came back from 2010 to 2019. And that's when I really got it. I finally figured out, wow, communism and socialism, given the chance to not be destroyed and have successful war declared on it like every other country, you know, Cuba, you know, Eritrea, you know, Vietnam, it's, you know, they all have war declared on them. Russia, well, USSR, and now Russia. You know, we can go on around Bolivia, Venezuela, many, many of them, DPRK, North Korea. But China is so big and so colossal and so powerful that nothing that the West can do can keep this communist socialist juggernaut from being successful. And so that's what it took. It took me to see that, you know,
cool.
But I understand that you, Amir, became more, and I think it's, for me, instead of saying radicalized, for me, it's like, became more normalized.
You sure?
Depropagandized. Yeah. It wasn't until I was about 56 that I became depropagandized. When did it happen for you? Debrainwashed.
It is. It's a process, right? It's not like a hallelujah.
Hello.
And you just one day find yourself out of the matrix. It's a constant every day and by degrees. Eventually you get there, and maybe I'm not even where I need to be yet, and maybe I'm still moving. But the invasion of Iraq was a big one. I mean, that was like the 2003 invasion of Iraq, because in the lead, and then weapons of mass destruction were not there and stuff like that. I mean, it sort of dawned on me, because I remember in the lead up to that, and I was, you know, just starting out in university, and in somewhat of a privileged position. Well, of course it is. I'm going to university. I'm in a, you know, developed, advanced country, Canada, whatever. And, I was reading 4 or 5 newspapers a day. And if I still was taken in by all of this, well, I'm taken in precisely by the newspaper. You know, what does the average person, like, how are you ever going to That's when I really understood, you know, when there was no weapons of mass destruction, that we live in a propaganda state. You know, that there is no way around it. I mean, if somebody who's at the university reading 3 or 4 newspapers a day, that person should know the truth. You know, that person should be well on their way to knowing what reality is. And the less of the newspapers and the less you tune in to all of that crap, you know, people who just kind of had a hunch and had an intuition. No, you know, I just think that this is imperialism at work again. And that's all you need. You don't need to go read 5 newspapers again to, you know, what is your evidence? Why do you say that? La, la, la. These are all just propaganda tricks. There is kind of an intuitive gut feeling that people know, you know, injustice is happening. And I knew that I was out of tune with that. I was not, and that bothered me. That really made me upset. Like, why were some people who are less educated than me understanding, you know, the nature of power relations and how the U.S. works, whereas me, I'm reading all these books and writing all these papers and reading all these newspapers, and I can't see it? Yeah, that really disturbed me. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started really, you could say, radicalizing and deliberalizing myself. Because before that, I was just the good liberal. Yeah, I was just trying to be like progressive, but like, come on, like, we got to see both sides here, and we got to see where...
The phony liberal.
Yeah, the phony,
I was just a cardboard liberal.
Yeah.
You know, thought I was a do-gooder.
Right, yes.
Had all the answers for the Chinese. We know better, and we're smarter.
And we appreciate, you know, the Chinese, you know, what they're doing, la, 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 la. But anyway, I mean, there's this guy, this Singaporean economist, Kishore Mahbubani, right? So he's making the rounds on social media. You know, I see in China, where he basically tells off this British reporter for, you know, basically bringing up, like, what do you, so the British reporter basically goes, oh, you know, so China, we know that they're an economic miracle and they're doing all these things, but what do you think about their, you know, repressive human rights? And
all the social question, the social system.
Exactly. And then,
which we talked about last.
Yes. Yeah, like all of these, you know, so how do you square that? So, of course, now Mahbubani has to answer this, you know, very pretentious put-on question, which is not a question, it's an accusation. Like, it's a question designed to, okay, audience, everyone listening, China is good, and we're talking about their, you know, promise and everything like that, but never forget all of these horrible human rights things that are happening. You have to stick in the reminder under the guise of, but I'm just being objective. Anyway, Mahbubani answers like a sort of gentleman, and he kind of knocks down all of the, you know, bullet talking points one by one, and it's really great. And then after watching that exchange, I was almost, which I usually am, well, it wasn't a victory at the same time for Mahbubani, because, and why wasn't it? Because I know what that British reporter is left thinking. He goes like, he doesn't exactly think that Mahbubani himself is brainwashed, but he leaves thinking, well, you know what, at least in my society, you can say that, and I can ask you that question, so we're better. And he believed not having changed his mind at all. So unless Mahbubani addresses that, you know, that's the only real exchange, which he won't, right? He's only going to stick to his talking points, you stick to yours. And the final talking point in the imperialist head is, well, in my society, you can talk about it, and we can talk about it freely, and in China, you can't. So even though they're successful, they can't talk about everything, you know, that's good and bad. Therefore, we are better.
Well, they actually can.
So that's
kind
of like,
now we know they can. Of course, they talk.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But, all right. Well, actually, for me, when I came back in 2010 with my wife and our eighth grade daughter, it was actually somebody, I started writing a little blog, you know, and somebody sent me a video of the World Trade Center building number 7 collapsing in free fall. And I'm a certified science teacher and a lifelong, you know, scientist. When I saw that, I thought, that's not possible.
Yeah.
And so for you, it was Iraq, you know, the genocide with the depleted uranium and the genocide in Iraq in 2000. And what year was that invasion?
2003.
Yeah, 2003. And the and for me, and once you kind of cross that, once you kind of get slapped in the face and see something that just jars you so much, you kind of take the plunge. You go, wow. And so, and you start looking for more information, and it's just like,
It's like it's like peeling an onion. And for me, it was the me proving to myself that 9/11 was an inside job, and that it was perpetrated by the U.S. government, and very 95% likely with Israel. And so it's just those kind of epiphanies, those kind of revelations that you cross can just completely just blow the scales off your eyes. And I never turned back. And that's why I wrote China Rising, because it exposed all the Western, the Western matrix, you know, the false flags and the genocide and everything. And we went to, and this is very difficult for people outside of China. By the way, we are in Amir's apartment. That's his nice little library behind us. And he's on the 39th floor of a nice skyscraper, high-rise apartment complex. We have a beautiful view of Changsha. But anyway, what was I talking about? That's what I wanted to say. I forgot.
We just finished off with the 9/11.
What was I going to say? Anyway,
we were just in Changsha, like looking around.
We went to. Yeah, this is difficult. We believe in communism and socialism. In fact, I joined the French Communist Party. I don't know how many years ago. Just although it's gentrified and completely right. Spineless, and
I feel the same. Most of Western.
Yeah, Western Communist parties. But I did it just to say, I'm a card carrying communist, because I seeing what China, you know, that has the power to resist Western destruction. And what this communist socialist country has done since 1921, when the Communist Party was founded, is breathtaking. It's beyond anybody's imagination. Tell us your feeling. We went to this museum yesterday. It was beautiful. Why do you have so much respect for the Communist Party of China, Amir? What it means to you, and also about the role the role of Mao Zedong in 20th century history.
Well, like, my favorite communist China is Red China, and the China under Mao. That's like for sure. And in a sense, you know, since the death of Mao, they've gone in a certain direction. And they brought in a lot of benefits and a lot of, you know, definitely you can see, yes, China is strong. But one thing, you know, that I want to always warn even some of my students about, you know, within the parameters that I can, is that when you get all the good stuff, you know, the technology and all the
consumer
goods, yeah. And there's a rising standard of living, rising wage, real wages and stuff like that. You also have to be careful, especially from the, you know, wars are fought on any front, but you also have to be careful on the propaganda cultural front, because once you start opening up, airways and stuff like that, this is why I'm absolutely, the Communist Party is totally correct to keep out Google, keep out,
Facebook,
all of that crap. That those are, you know, fifth columns. That is how you destabilize a country. I mean, look what's happening in Russia. Russia allows all that crap in, and China does not. So maintain that. But, you know, information and cultural, like, China wants to do, you want to promote yourself, you want to engage in real cultural relations, but how do you do that with an enemy? How do you do that with somebody who hates you, you know?
And wants to destroy you.
If I see myself as having a kind of a role here as an academic or whatever, it would be to remind all my comrades, you know, just be careful, because you're benefiting a lot, and make sure you're taking as much as you can from the West, but it is a double-edged sword, never forget that. And just to kind of be careful. I mean, what can I say? Like, human rights is a good example, right? I mean, human rights is just something that the West uses to parade other countries.
Invade them.
But even like culturally and from a proper...
The right to protect.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But Libya, Syria.
And it's very subtle, right, when it comes in. Like, and I always tell, you know, even when I talk about feminism, for example, in my classes. Now, I am not by any means suggesting, right, that there isn't a gender problem in China, that there isn't a gender, you know, male, female, that there aren't some inequalities and stuff like that. I would be the, well, first of all, I'm not qualified to even have an opinion really on that. I'm not Chinese. I didn't grow up in China. I'm a man. But, you know, one thing I always tell, if you import the so-called Western solutions to that problem, you will be just as screwed up as the West is. Because look at them, they haven't solved it, you know? Yeah. It's almost like they're not interested in solving it. They're just interested in exacerbating societal tensions. So when the Communist Party comes in and says, you know what, no rainbow flags, no, you know, rainbow cakes, we're getting all this gender equality propaganda out of our country. Well, now you accuse Xi and the Communist Party of being authoritarian. But that's not it at all. Like, that is not it at all. Who would be against any genuine, sincere attempt to, you know, create more symmetrical relations between the genders and the sexes in China, in the West, anywhere? Why would you be against it? Why would I be against it? You have two daughters. I have a daughter. No, we want to see women thrive and grow. But when they do it through wokeism, and when I see that crap in China, and I see very sincere social energy of, you know, young women who are frustrated with maybe patriarchal conditions that do exist in China, but when they reach for Western solutions, beware. I mean, really beware, because what are you going to get? You know, you will get three washrooms. Will that solve your problem? No. I mean, it's not going to solve your problem, but that is the only solution the West will give you, and it will make you feel like you're progressing, but you're actually regressing. It's retrograde, and it's designed to sort of destabilize and take away social cohesion, because that's what they want. And that is, human rights is a great way to destabilize.
To divide people.
Right.
Identity politics. Yeah.
So I hope most of my students get that. But so every once in a while I do see, you know, oh, we're having a feminist reading group or a feminist study group. And, you know, I'm wondering, who's funding this? Where is it coming from? Like, how is this? And I always say, on any of my campuses, if I ever see like a third washroom, I'll just faint through a lot. Mm-hmm. I hope I never see that.
Tell us about a lot of people don't know that something about Hunan University, and I want Amir to tell us about it. It has a unique distinction. But what about Mao Zedong? Why do you respect and admire him so much?
The first essay that I read that really turned my attention to Mao Zedong was Alain Badiou. A French philosopher. The Cultural Revolution.
You sent it?
Yeah.
I read that.
Yeah, wow, that was amazing. The Cultural Revolution, the last revolution, meaning that was the last time humanity could imagine an alternative to capitalism. You know, and it isn't just taking a real human transformation isn't just taking the best of capitalism and trying to kind of reform it and control it. You know, Marx even says, once the genie is out of the bottle, once you unleash capitalist forces in your society, they're hard to put it back. I mean, the Communist Party, at least in China, China definitely has a capitalist class, they have a billionaire class, and then there's people. And the Communist Party is in between. And they are doing their best to rein in the billionaire class to make sure that they don't, you know, rape the people too much. Whereas in the West, there is no buffer. There is no party buffer, Democrat, Republican, will just do anything that their corporate masters want. So in China, the people have a shield, and that is the Communist Party. But I'm not sure anymore how interested China is in changing actual lived social relations, because that's a real revolution, you know, how you and I relate to each other, how we work, the work that I do, how is it beneficial to you, my relationship with my neighbors, my relationship with my commune, with my country, and that kind of, you know, that to me is what, you know, Mao understood. He said, it's not enough just to, you know, take their technology and just advance in the sense that we take the best and we try and control the worst aspects of it. And in that sense, why even import the worst at all? Why not change human relations in such a way that, you know, that those things aren't even a problem? You know? Like, you know, the gender thing is the transgender thing, let's put it that way. Nobody in China is worried about how many genders there are, you know? But one day that may become a problem. I mean, I see it now. If you want to publish in, again, those SSCI Index Journal, and you write some, you know, woke article about how many genders there are, and you draw from this, and I get, you know, published, and I get, basically, in the SSCI Index Journal, I get a check on my, you know, job performance review, and the school gets a check on his job.
For being a wokist.
For being a wokist, yeah. And I'm not even saying that anybody in my department would even know what I'm writing about. But if I was wanting to publish in that vein, it would check all the boxes for me, it would check all the boxes for the school. It's just very insidious. You know, all of this kind of woke stuff. And it's around, yeah. So, yeah, changing our social. Anyway, then suddenly something that was not a problem for any Chinese person ever, wondering if there's more than two genders, slowly starts to become a problem. It's a created, fabricated problem, a propaganda problem, you see. And that's what happens with reform and opening up. It seeps in. It's not the Communist Party wants this or doesn't want this. The Communist Party is open, and they want to advance, and they want to take the good stuff. But you can't just take in the good stuff. When the good stuff comes, all the crap comes too. And you can try and keep it out, and they're doing a good job. Google and Facebook and all that. But,
and the foreign NGO law.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
To control the Soros.
You have to be vigilant.
NED.
Right. At the same time, right, in 2020, China created the most billionaires in the world, you know, single-handedly. So now there, now you have a new enemy to fight and to be vigilant over. So Mao's solution was like, why do we create conditions where we have to import that stuff at all, right? Why not just actually transform lived human relations in its totality? And to me, that's why Mao was so inspirational, because not only did he win the revolution in 1949, by the time 1966 came around, he took a look around and he saw already in 1966, the Communist Party is becoming a class rule party, meaning all of the best medical care, all of the best education opportunities were going to party members. And Mao didn't like that. This is his own party, right? This is the party that he founded and he loved. And he said, wait a minute, all the warriors who fought and died for me, they're not benefiting. The revolution's for them. Now, the real historical question, this is what Baidu talks about in its wonderful essay, that Mao is the first man in history to face a historical contradiction. How do I use the power of the state to undermine the state? And Mao, the Cultural Revolution wasn't about destroying the Communist Party. It was about reforming the Communist Party to make sure that it served the people. And all revolutions do this, right? You have a revolution, great revolutionary energy, but the old habits and the old ways are still with us. You know, you start to, okay, let's just take the easy, you know, the easy road, and let's just get the day-by-day sort of benefits, and let's forget the long-term class struggle, international vision. Let's just do this day-by-day and progress slowly and slowly. You know, this is Deng's famous feeling rocks in the water. And I guess you could say, Mao said, okay, yes, maybe we're feeling rocks in the water, but you have to stay focused on where you want to be on the other side, and you have to keep that in mind. If you're just looking down at the rocks, and you don't know where you're going to end up. And before you know it, you might be a revisionist party or a capitalist party. And to have the courage to really understand that I am now in a position of power, and in my position of power, I will use it to undermine the very power structure that I am part of. For the people. I mean, who does that? I mean, there is virtually no historical figure, you know, who does that. Anyway, Ramin Mazahiri also wrote a great 8-part piece at the Saker, where he kind of says the first cultural revolution was the Shia revolution in Islam, but the grandson of the Prophet was actually trying to do the same thing. Yeah. Muhammad started a great revolution, and the grandson of the Prophet he saw that the gains of the revolution were being lost quickly, and he wanted to sort of rejigger the same Islamic revolution over the world, and it wasn't successful. And the second cultural revolution, because that's what a cultural revolution is. You've already won the revolution. Now you have to defeat the counter-revolution successfully.
Yeah, because they're coming.
Everybody's out there. It's relentless. I mean, and look, the Soviet Union's gone and everything like that. And Mao is sort of ahead of his time. And I really admire. That is something that I think even Chinese people have a hard time appreciating about Mao. And that's why I think he's such a great man.
Yeah, I always say, and we don't have time to get into all the nitty-gritty, but you can read the China Trilogy and learn all about it. I always say, never has one leader done so much for so many people in so short of time as Mao Zedong. And that's it. You know, he 500 million people, and then when he died, it was a billion people, and they were liberated from Western hegemony, Western genocide, and very, very, very few countries can make that claim. And he was an incredibly visionary, brilliant visionary leader.
And I really think that vision lasted right until his dying day. Everyone thinks he just got old and got confused in his later life and China went astray for 10 years. I mean, I don't agree with that at all. You can even say China went astray and that mistakes were made or whatever. But Mao knew the reasons for those mistakes. It's because we have to rearrange human relations, and this is going to be a long revolutionary process. And of course, it will be chaotic.
So. We take a lot of taxis, and I talk, talk to a lot of people, you will talk to Chinese people anywhere you go, and they will tell you, if there was no Mao Zedong, there would be no free China. And free China means not being a Western whore,
right,
like Indonesia or Philippines or Japan, South Korea. We could go on and on, you know. I mean, well, New Zealand, Australia, the whole West, you know, are beholden to Western imperial capitalism. So, an amazing visit yesterday to the museum. Tell us the interesting factoid about Hunan University that the West denies, says it's not true, or pretends that it's not true.
You should tell us about this, Jeff. I learned it from you.
Okay. Hunan University is the first university in the world, 759 AD. And they actually, Hunan University, right here in Changsha, actually preceded Oxford and Cambridge.
Incredible.
And so, you know, not by many years. I mean, it was, you know, I think the Oxford and Cambridge were, you know, maybe just a few decades before. But this, he is teaching, Amir is teaching at the oldest university in the world. And it's really an amazing campus, and they've got a beautiful, well, he said there's 9 campuses. It's just unbelievable. But there's and of course, there's a massive statue of Mao at Hunan University. But, you know, it's really, really hard to find anybody. You'll find the occasional crank. You'll find the occasional crank that doesn't like Mao. But even the ones that don't like Mao will tell you that, well, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be here today. I mean, that's basically what they're saying. I didn't really like what he did, you know. And these are a lot of people who were on the wrong end of the stick of the Cultural Revolution, or their families and their children and their grandchildren, but even those, you know, say, well, you know, without him, you know, we would not be here today.
Yeah, be more like India.
So anyway, well, this has been fun. I will put our first interview on the webpage. I will make sure I get the PDF of this Cultural Revolution article that you gave me. It was translated into English, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I would only be.
Yeah, yeah, it was translated into English, so it's in English. I'm sure it was probably originally in French. The French have some incredible, incredible philosophers and thinkers. So anyway, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
You have been a wonderful host. I've got to go back to Shenzhen tomorrow and wrap up my trip. I am coming back to China in August to finalize my business. My business is one person, me. But anyway, it will give me the opportunity to get a business visa and not spend hundreds of euros for one entry. I'll get a one-year multiple entry visa. And hopefully I can come back in August if you're here.
Always welcome.
And we'll go. And this city is unbelievable. I do want to encourage everybody, if you are not on my Twitter, you need to get on it, because I'm just every day, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm probably driving a mirror crazy by taking pictures constantly, because there's just so much to tell you. And it's just go to Twitter at 44_D and then AYS at 44_days with the capital D. That's the name of my first book. And you will be amazed at China. It's just nothing like it. There's just nothing like it in the world. I know Amir feels very, very lucky to be here. And he's found his passion, English literature and English writing. And I know that you're going to get your 3 articles published in academic journals, so you'll stay here in Changsha, this incredible city. This city has 12 million people. Shenzhen has 14 million people, and they're second-tier cities. They're just second-tier cities. Not that big of a deal. Amazing. Amir?
Yes.
Thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure, comrade.
And comrade Amir, and I will give you also a Buddhist bow, because China has always been and always will be Confucius, Taoist, and Buddhist. Well, communism is Confucius, Taoist, and Buddhist. I mean, that's just all there is to it. It's just got kind of a different name to it. Anyway, thanks a lot, and I will be looking forward for the fans to see this. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.